Professor Manaz Afridi, give me a name.
Inayat Nur Khan.
Welcome to Give Me a Name, where a guest presents me, Ben Kirschenbaum, with a dead historical figure they find interesting, and we discuss. Check out Professor Afridi's story, The Blue Angel and the Holocaust. Link in the episode description. Now, on with the episode. Okay, I'm here with Professor Manaz Afridi. She is a professor of religious studies at Manhattan College and also the director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center here at Manhattan College. And I'm sitting here in the center.
Yes, you are, in my exhibit. Yes.
Which she's designed that's specifically about Hermann Ziering.
Correct.
And has a lot of just sort of cool information and cool artifacts around.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for being here. So we're talking about, I don't know, should we refer to her throughout? The book that I read about Nur Inayat Khan, I'm going to pronounce it wrong.
That's right. That's right. Nur Inayat Khan. Yeah.
Refers to her as Nur throughout the book, but I feel like maybe that's just because her father's also a character in the book and her family in general.
Right. Inayat Khan is her last name.
Okay.
And Nur, which means light, is her name.
And she, well, just to briefly recap, was a writer, musician, and most famously, a spy for the British during World War II, and died tragically at the age of 30 in Dachau.
Correct. Yeah.
So a little bit about her background, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, she's you know, for me, one of my heroines, and I don't think many people know a lot about her. She was born in Moscow in 1911 to a family that was connected to Tipu Sultan. Tipu Sultan was her great-great-great-grandfather. So in the 1800s, he was one of the kings in Mysore in India, where most of the Muslims were ruling under the Mughal Empire. And he was well known for his giving up his empire. And so he was kind of celebrated. And she comes from that family, so she indeed was a princess, technically. And her own father, Inayat Khan, was a Sufi scholar, and he was somebody who became a mystic very early on and traveled the whole world and eventually met his mother, Baker, who was her last name, who converted to Hasina Begum as a Sufi woman, and then they had their daughter, Nur.
And Sufi Muslims, sort of mystic Islam?
Yeah, I mean, you can be either, like the largest denomination is Sunni Islam, mm-hmm. which is 80% of Muslims, and then 20% is Shiite Islam. You can be a Sufi Sunni or a Sufi Shia. Sufi is an approach to God. They believe in everything that, say, Sunnis do, or if they're Shiites. But it's an approach to God which has to do with ecstasy. It's a different way of prayer. It's a kind of methodology that's different from your mainstream Muslims. So, for example, you could compare that to Jewish mysticism, where you have the Kabbalah and different ways of approaching Judaism from, say, Reform or Orthodox Jews, I mean, the two that come to mind in terms of the most popular. And then same thing with Christianity. You had the Christian mystics. And what was interesting is mysticism, in terms of Sufism, was very popular in the West. It was taken on by a lot of British and Americans, at the same time that Buddhism and Hinduism was very popular as well.
And her father was, and this obviously is going to be relevant later on, was a big proponent of religious tolerance and different religions kind of coming together.
Yeah, he was all about peace. He was all about nonviolence. He raised his family, and his wife was always about nonviolence. And, you know, we're talking about, at that time, pre-World War One, going into World War One and then into Two. So we're talking about a time where you had a lot of nationalism, you had a lot of problems, you had a lot of poverty and despair, and you had a lot of kind of rise of secularism, but also the rise of violence against religion. So he comes out of this kind of beautiful tradition of tolerance, peace, love, and Islam itself comes from the root of peace. So he used that over and over again as a Sufi mystic and became very well known at a young age.
And he was a musician too.
He was a musician. He played the vina, or the sitar, as you call it. It's an instrument with 8 strings. It looks like it's a guitar.
Yeah.
But it's got a huge kind of ball at the end, a wooden ball. My mother used to play it, so I know a lot about it. And it's the same instrument that Ravi Shankar was known for, the sitar music. So it's also a very soothing kind of way of relaxing and praying. And sometimes music is intertwined with prayer in the Sufi tradition.
Mm. And then so Noor grows up, so as you said, born in Moscow, but raised in her very early life in England, mm-hmm. and then outside of Paris for kind of most of her childhood, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. So her father meets the mother. She's actually American when he's traveling.
In New Mexico, right?
Yeah, New Mexico, which is sister. I mean, it just tells you how globalized we were back then, right? I mean, we think about it as a new thing today, but back then also we were very globalized. And then she grows up basically in England, then moves to France, and then that's when her story really begins, where she is somebody who is also a musician. She plays a harp really well. She also has really good writing instruction at home. She's homeschooled. And she also is very much interested in stories, fables, like Aesop fables, right? So ethical stories. And she starts to write children's stories. And that's when she published Yukata Tales as a very young woman. So you're talking about like she's 20, 21 at that point. And these stories, if you read them, they're really moral stories about peace and nonviolence and getting along. And these stories for children to emulate themselves for these kind of moral ways of being in the world where you're not greedy, but you're really inclusive, where you're not about the self and the ego, which is what Sufism teaches, that you let go of the self and the ego. Also very much influenced by the Buddhist tradition, because remember, they are originally from India, where all of these different traditions converge together, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam.
Not to jump ahead too much, but this question of peaceful resistance becomes the big dilemma when World War II breaks out.
Yeah, I mean, World War II breaks out, and then things turn completely in 1940 when the Germans come into France to take over France. And Velayat is Noor's brother. Mm-hmm. And they both are sitting there thinking about what to do because they really hate and abhor fascism. It's completely opposite of how they were raised. It's completely opposite of their philosophy and who they are. And they hate what's going on around them and to their friends. Noor also at the same time falls in love with a Jewish man. And it doesn't work out because of families. But she still understands that all people are human. And she sees the kind of anti-Semitism that's going on around her, against Jews especially. And she decides she wants to do something about it.
And her father is actually already dead at this point.
Yes.
He dies when she's an early teenager.
13, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they have to flee France. They go to England. And her brother, I guess, gets involved first, or they kind of do it together?
They do together. I mean, they get on to the last boat.
Right, right.
Leaving from France to England. They have to escape. They go to England, and they both then decide. They sit down and talk to each other. And there's a whole conversation about nonviolence and what should we do. We have to act. We have to act against the aggressors. We have to do something to help out. Velayat goes into the army, and she joins the auxiliary air force, basically, as one of the first women to do that. And then after that, in 1942, she is spotted as somebody who could spy for the British.
Which, I mean, is crazy. I mean, there are a few attributes, I guess, that she has that makes her sort of ideal. The main one being that she speaks several languages.
Yeah, French and English, fluently.
So there's that. There's also, I read some stuff about, like, she's good, a good musician, good at knitting. So, like, there's, like, an aspect of, like, being good with your hands, which is important if she's going to be a radio transmitter.
Yes, exactly. It's interesting. If you look in the archives, they do have reports on Inayat Noor Khan. And one of the things about the reports is that they're looking for people. They need help in France for the resistance. They need communication. This is the British, right? So what happens is they're looking for candidates that can do this, but they know that this is a very impossible job. She ends up with this job because she's very good with her hands. Not only that, but as somebody who is a good musician and can knit well, has excellent memory, and can do something repeatedly well with complete accuracy. On her reports, it says, oh, she doesn't have the brains for this, she doesn't have the stomach for this. But then her boss, Gary's friend, who actually she eventually works for in France, tells her, you know how you really don't like to lie? Well, when you miss a beat, then you will be lying to someone. And that just kind of sticks in her head.
Right. Yeah. I kept reading same thing, that she hates to lie, which you'd think is not a great attribute for a spy. So what she ends up joining is, what's the acronym?
SOE.
SOE, yeah. Which I guess is...
Special Operatives Executives.
So it's it's not the MI6.
No.
Because MI6 is more local, I guess.
Yeah.
And she makes her way back to Paris. Okay. So she's a spy in Paris.
Yeah.
And things go terribly sort of immediately with her mission.
Right. So she's working for a spy mission called Prosner. And she has all kinds of instructions. She changes her name to Renier, a French name. She that concocts a story about who she is. She has a completely different identity. And she goes in and she finds out that all the operatives she's supposed to be working with are being arrested.
Yeah, yeah.
By the Gestapo.
And it was immediately. It was immediately. Just a disaster. Yeah.
As if she was sent there to become a disaster.
Right, right.
You know? And it's like, oh my God. You know, so, you know, when you're reading about her, you're like, what's going to happen? This is it for her. So, I mean, they say that the life expectancy at that time of a spy was 6 weeks, but she lasts 3 months doing this. So her job becomes really, really hard because she realizes that there's no one to work with. She's the only British spy working in Paris. And so she decides to move every 20 minutes from different places to different places so she can transmit back to the British. However, as you know, she's discovered.
And she also has to lug around
the whole transmitter.
This giant thing. And she's petite. She's I think they described her pretty short.
Yeah.
And so she is captured by the Gestapo.
Right. But you know what's interesting is, you know how she's captured, right?
I was reading a little bit about it. It seems like it was the sister of Gary. The original guy.
Yeah. So she got 100,000 francs.
Yeah.
So Gestapo was desperate. They really wanted to find her. They couldn't really track her down. So they went around asking people, and she took 100,000 francs, and they found her location, and then she was arrested and taken to the Gestapo headquarters in Paris, and she spent some time there, tried to escape twice, and then finally she was taken to Forchheim prison, where she was tortured for 10 months. And one of the things about her experience in prison is that there were people who heard her, other women in that prison. And they said that she was tortured every day. And why was she being tortured? She was tortured for information and information on others. And she never, ever gave up any information. And then finally she was murdered at Dachau, shot in the head. So... Yeah. Very sad.
With three other, there were three other women, right?
There were three other women, but she was, I think, the last woman to be shot. And they arrested the man that shot her, and they indicted him. So we have a lot of information on that
On the actual scene of the murder. I think, I don't know, is it just lore that her last word was liberty or something?
No, that's what they say.
That's what they say, okay.
Yeah, that's what they say. And so, you know, one of the things about Noor is that, you know, she's really a heroine. She's a heroine of the East, for Islam, for Asian women, and also for the British.
Yeah. And was honored posthumously.
Yes.
With the George Medal.
Yeah, the George Cross. Yeah.
Which is as big as it gets for non-royalty.
Right. And then there's they have a bust of her at the Grosvenor Garden Park where she used to live. So it's a big honor for her, but it's also a story that I think really gets to me in my heart. I'm a Muslim woman, I'm an Asian, and I work on Holocaust issues and anti-Semitism. So it's like, oh my God,
this is
this is amazing, right? So I think she's a young woman to look up to, but she's also somebody I think that really shows a humanness of who she is. She takes her faith very seriously in terms of social justice and mm-hmm. ethics. And she's somebody who does not betray and is trustworthy until the very end. And the fact that Muslims were murdered at Dachau, and also, I mean, I have paperwork on Muslims being murdered in Auschwitz, gives it a different kind of twist and narrative in terms of Holocaust, but also expanding the education of Holocaust. So that's why I'm interested in her as a historical figure.
Yeah, and certainly in terms of, and I know that this is one of the things that you work on and write about, Muslim-Jewish relations and how post-World War II, that obvious tensions in certain areas of the world.
Yeah.
You wrote a short story that you sent over to me that I really enjoyed, which was the title of it The Blue Angel and the Holocaust?
Yes,
okay.
It was.
So The Blue Angel refers to Noor because she loved wearing blue, mm-hmm. and the rumor, I suppose, was that because she wore so much blue, that was part of what got her captured, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that it gave her away or something like that.
Yes. It was because the woman, the one who told on her, Gary's sister, told her to wear blue, and she gave that code to the Gestapo.
And so the short story that you write is an imagined conversation between three figures. Would you mind describing who the two figures other than Noor are?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, sort of an experimental piece, but I really enjoyed doing it because it brought a lot of things together. One is Noor. The second person is a man, Berkan Azarki, who was an Algerian resistance fighter in Algeria when the Vichy government were in control, and he was put in prison with other Jews. And he has written a memoir that was published in 1964 talking about the brotherhood mm-hmm. of Jews and Muslims at that time, and I love that story. And then the third one was Sidney Sharif, who was the Jew that was taken from Algeria, and then he fought against the French. So there's all, you know, these three stories are really important to me because what I'm doing is showing people and showing the audience that Arab Jews and Arab Muslims were on the same side, that colonization was such a big problem that it really, and if you read Berkani's novel, which is the Algerian Muslim guy, you start to realize how the Vichy captains would really separate Jews and Muslims because they wanted them to fight each other. And the Muslims that were bystanders during the Vichy government were told, you're next. You don't think that you're better than this race. So there's a lot of really interesting kind of marginal information, not marginal to most Muslims and Arabs, but marginal to the world and the Holocaust education world, that needs to sort of be talked about. Because I think this is a point of mutual understanding and mutual agreement of what situation these people were in. And that's why I bring the three of them together and them talking to each other and also arguing with each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
It seems like it's cordial. Or, well, at one point, one of the characters does raise his voice, I believe. But for the most part, they're, you know, having a real talk. And you sum up the story by saying the importance of such a, you know, sort of polite conversation.
All right. And you know, it's also called The Blue Angel because Marlene Dietrich was a dissenter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she played the Blue Angel.
And so, yeah. So Marlene Dietrich, who also was very anti-Nazi and left Germany.
Yeah.
So she starred in a movie where she plays Noor. Is that right?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's a totally different movie. It's called The Blue Angel.
Yeah, yeah.
Directed by Josef von Sternberg.
Okay.
And it's about basically a cabaret singer. And she, that was one of her first movies. So I thought it was really interesting to put these two together. Marlene Dietrich, a German, who gives up her citizenship and goes and wants to be with the Allies because she hates fascism.
Just to go back for a second, because you talk about the relationship between colonialism or Algeria, you know, wanting its freedom from France while the war is going on. That's also a big dilemma for Noor with regards to India.
Yes, absolutely. So she wants to fight against the British. And that's one thing that Tipu Sultan was known for, is that he was really against the British Empire and the colonization. And he was involved with the Indian Mutiny, which is really famous in terms of colonial history. I mean, all of these stories are very complicated, but it's also very important to look at these stories because Muslims were under colonization for about 300 years, Ben. That's a long time.
I agree. Yeah.
Right? I mean, their language, like it's, you know, I mean, my mom, who grew up in Pakistan, basically, right? Because it was, you know, created in 1947, close to Israel, right? 1948.
Sure.
Grew up going to Catholic school because the missionaries were there. And she grew up speaking English and understanding a lot of the culture was kind of disappeared under the British. So your language was changed, your faith was changed, the way you dressed was changed. I mean, it was a lot of impact of colonials, and we're still feeling the colonization today in most of the Arab world.
Going back to the story for a moment, would you mind, so a lot of it has to do with, or I guess the most important parts of it have to do with the commonality and the common experiences between Muslims and Jews. Noor's character, as far as I read it, was kind of the peacemaker between these two other opposing views. What some of the disagreements were between the other two characters when they did disagree with each other?
I think it was about who suffered.
Right.
Right? I mean, and this is the contention, right? You know, I just recently, somebody wrote an article in The Ford about Rashid Tlaib, who did a day of celebration, or not celebration, memory of the Nakba for the Palestinians. So a lot of Jews were upset that how can you remember the Nakba? That was when Israel became a state. Now, the contention is here. On one side, people will say, well, you're just disavowing the state of Israel. And the other side, you'll say, well, you're disavowing the loss, right? And why I bring this up is that it really is not about loss and gain. It's about acknowledging what the narratives are, what the other narrative is about. So if you acknowledge that it was a catastrophe for Palestinians, acknowledge it, because that's how they feel, right? And if you acknowledge that it was a celebration for Jews because they finally had their own land called Israel, acknowledge that. Difficult to do. And what Noor does is that she becomes a catalyst for us to think through her actions, right? She is giving up her life because she cares about Jews and she cares about fighting fascism, not because she's being attacked necessarily, but because people that she thinks are human are being attacked. So she becomes that catalyst in one person that brings those narratives together, regardless of what side of the narrative you're on. And I think that is the most important thing in terms of acknowledging one's suffering. Now, Barkhane was imprisoned and he was tortured for 3 years in a camp in Algeria. And Sidney Sharif had to escape from the Holocaust, basically, from being killed or being in prison in Algeria. And when Barkhane talks about his suffering, Sidney Sharif is like, what are you talking about? Right? I'm a Jew. I was being, you know, people were being murdered. That is the sort of, you know, kind of collapse of dialogue where I'm saying, no, that's where dialogue begins. When you start to say, oh, I do not agree with you. My pain was bad. It doesn't mean that your pain is less.
Yeah, I think it is very easy. And I feel myself, my mind always goes to maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just who, you know, the culture I grew up in or whatever, but it's very easy to be competitive with this kind of thing. I mean, it's silly to be competitive about suffering, but it is, you know, when you compare different atrocities throughout history, it's very easy to go, you know, oh, well, this one was slightly worse than the other, as opposed to just they were all bad and this is a opportunity for empathy.
Right, exactly. I mean, I don't think we can measure everyone's suffering from our own little box and our own perspective. You know, I've taken it my job to fight anti-Semitism as a Muslim because I think it's more powerful. I wish that that Jews would fight for me and Islamophobia, and they do. I have seen that in New York City especially. So I think that we all have sort of, you know, a role and a journey to live by. And because I fight against anti-Semitism, it doesn't mean I don't care about my Palestinian brothers and sisters. If I fight against Islamophobia, it doesn't mean I don't care about my Jewish brothers and sisters. So I think you can be somebody who has a journey, who has a point, and embody a different identity. And I think that is Inayat Noor Khan's story, which is so pivotal to us today in the contemporary world, because we are so black and white about many issues, as you know, as everyone who's on social media or you're, you know, on podcasts, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's like you got to be on the side or not play this game. There's no nuance anymore.
No, I mean, a lot of the times different causes are just broken down into two or three word, you know, hashtags.
Exactly. Right. So, I mean, what I want to do is allow people to have that voice and to add nuance. Look, Ben, I don't agree with everything that Israel does, but I also don't agree with everything the Palestinian Authority does. I don't agree with everything the United States does or Pakistan does, right? But I have the freedom to say that and still be a human being and say, well, I really am not against Americans, because that would be against me. I'm a Muslim American. I'm not against Muslims, right? I'm not against Jews. Obviously, I've dedicated my life to this. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways of critiquing and taking a side without extinguishing a race of people.
Can you tell us, I mean, is this the, in general, at the center here, is that kind of the major philosophy or the message that you try to get across to your students?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, I've developed this course called Muslims in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And so people, you know, kids are really intrigued by that. Muslims and Catholics and some Jews. I mean, we don't have a lot of Jews because it's a Catholic college.
Right.
But we have a growing Muslim population and they take my classes. And they have no idea what I'm going to do. But what I'm really talking to them about is colonization and North Africa, what happened in North Africa, and show the relationship between Jews and Muslims, meaning Jewish Arabs and Muslim Arabs. And then also we talk about Israel and Palestine. We talk about the creation of the state of Israel. We talk about the need for Israel. And we talk about what happened to Palestinians. So it's not as I'm teaching in a vacuum. I'm also talking about contemporary issues. Now, not all of my students will agree with me. Hmm. And there have been very, very, tense moments in my class, as you can imagine. But at the same time, if we don't have those tensions as an educator in a higher ed, then we got nothing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm trying to think if I ever took a class. I also went to a Catholic university. I'm trying to think if I...
Who are you?
I went to Georgetown.
Okay.
Yeah. Which, I mean, has a lot of Jews, but also, you know, the origin as a Jesuit school. They actually made a real point at the school to have theology classes, and obviously it was probably different 200 years ago, but now the theology classes are, you know, embracing mm-hmm. all different sorts mm-hmm. of religions. So I definitely had a few classes. One class I took was on religious mysticism, so that's how I know... what it means. But when you're going about teaching a class or, you know, choosing a curriculum, is it a difficult, especially if you're talking about like Israel, Palestine or some super controversial issue, is it difficult to pick the readings so that they're, you know, express different points of view?
I mean, I show both.
Right.
But, you know, I think my message as a professor is humanize each other, right? We have to humanize each other and not just take a side. Like I said, you know, once you say, you know, all Palestinians are terrorists or all Israelis are, you know, colonists, right? And they want to kill mm-hmm. Palestinians. You've just kind of like given up. You really have. You've given up on your intelligence. You've given up on information. You've given up on humanity. You've really, really given up. And I experienced that with people that have done that. I mean, I've heard people say, oh, I thought Zionism meant killing Jews. And I'm like, wow. You know, like, no. Let's get educated. Let's talk about what Zionism is. And I've done like series for Jewish groups like Hadassah on what is Zionism and the differences of Zionism. It has a very long history and why it came about. So there's a lot of things that because we have this tendency to protect ourselves from the fear of the other. And I think that it's a terrible, horrible, constructed way that we have been formed. It's not necessary that we do this. And I think that if you are teaching a class on these contentious issues, then you have to be careful and say, look, I come with my own prejudice, which obviously I do, Ben, right? Mm-hmm. And I may say something, but I'm not here to say don't say anything because you're going to offend someone, because we need to sort of get into the raw material.
Right.
Otherwise, we are not going to transform together.
Yeah, and what else is college for, right, than to challenge?
Well, it's problematic these days, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, going back to sort of Noor just as a real three-dimensional human being, one thing that a theme that during my research appeared throughout was her love of family.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, when her father dies, she really becomes the caretaker of the family. Her mother is sort of just distraught.
Depressed, yeah.
And she, the main reason, it seems like, why she was at all hesitant to become a spy wasn't really fear of her life, but more fear of losing her family and, mm-hmm. and how devastated they would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a core thing in terms of Indian Muslim culture. The family is mm-hmm. very important. And I think that, you know, young girls in especially Asian Indian culture are seen as more mature and responsible. They're looked upon, okay, you need to be maternal now. You need to take care of things.
Even as, I mean, she was a teenager. Yeah.
Just 13 years old.
Yeah.
And I think her mother kind of gave up just completely in despair and depression. And so she had two choices. One was to stay there and to take care of it. But it was also her brother that became her partner in terms of being part of the anti-fascism movement. And I think that was really important. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we should probably mention is that, you know, in Germany during the Weimar Republic, they had a Weimar force, which is not the Gestapo, but it was already an intelligence organization that seeped into what we call Nazi socialism today. So there was already an existing force in 1914, all the way up to 1945. And also in France, they had a paramilitary organization. So when she went for training, she had to learn what those uniforms look like because they were still in existence. So it's interesting when we look at the history of, say, World War II, you know, we usually start 1933 when Hitler took power, but we should really be looking a little bit earlier.
Right. Yeah. It didn't just show up out of nowhere.
Yeah. And same in France in terms of looking at the kind of little bit whisperings of what was going to become the Vichy.
Right. Or going all the way back to the Dreyfus Affair.
Exactly.
Or
1800. Even. Right. Yeah. 1890s. Yeah.
Learning about her life is obviously it's a tragic story, but there's also, when it comes to the spy stuff, there's a certain James Bondy sort of like excitement to it.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that I like, the easy ways that people could be caught as being a spy just by giving away little cultural things. The way that people are caught if they talk in their sleep or mm-hmm. like something like mm-hmm. that, which I think is also part of what makes her story just so gripping and maybe would bring people in for, you know, studying about her and about how what it reflects in general.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I should mention is that she was stopped by the Gestapo with her little briefcase of the transmitter, right? And he says, "What is that?" And she goes, "Oh, you know, it's just a radio," right? And then he helps her put the aerial up. Because he doesn't know what it looks
that
like.
That he's literally hurting the German cause.
Yeah. He's hurting his own cause, and he helps her with the aerial, and then he leaves, and she's very charming, you know, she's dressed well, and so he leaves her, and then she starts to transmit information back to England. So, that, you know, she got away with a lot of this stuff because she was smart. She's very clever. She was smart. She had been around the world. Think about it. You know, she traveled. She knew about the world. She was very well read, very highly educated, and that helps. She had a very creative fictional mind. That helps us buy James Bond story, you know, in terms of that. She learned how to shoot a gun. She learned how to parachute. So these are real skills that made her who she was.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, talking to me about this fascinating figure and also about, you know, your general outlook and what you try to profess here at Manhattan College.
Thank you, Ben. That was a real pleasure.